Welcome. Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. I've been delighted to have him on before discussing crucial issues. His important book that we've discussed a few times, The Good Soldier on Trial, A Sociological Study of Misconduct by the U.S. Military Pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle in Iraq. It shows the way the U.S. military operates, rules of engagement like ordering young soldiers, you know, colonels and captains and majors and so on, ordering young soldiers to kill all Iraqi military age, all military age Iraqi men, maybe even women, on site. Well, what's a military-aged man or woman or anybody else? Shoot them all, basically, that's what's said. Shoot and ask questions later. I guess that used to be a slogan in the Old West in America. Stepan, it's great to have you on. I just want to give listeners a brief update on what's going on in eastern Ukraine right now. There are referendums still ongoing. The polling stations, I believe in two regions, in the Donetsk region, in the Lugansk region, home to millions of eastern Ukrainians. I think originally they were open at 8 a.m. I think they were supposed to stay open till 10 a.m. Many are staying open until that hour, which is about another from New York time, that would be about another hour or so. But a good many of them closed early, anywhere from 6 to 8 p.m., because people there are living in a war zone. There are personal security issues at stake. So some of the polls closed early, and yet despite everything going on, the turnout is enormous, absolutely enormous. I checked several times earlier before the program began. An earlier report showed lower turnout. It began rising. It said in Lugansk region, it was about 75%. The first report I saw on Donetsk was 30%, then it jumped to 50%, then it jumped to 70%. When it's all over, it may turn out the way the pre-election polls predicted, around 83%. Now, 83% is remarkable under any conditions. In conflict conditions, it's almost unheard of. But apparently, I mean, you have to be there to sense what's going on. I do believe that the vast majority of eastern Ukrainians don't necessarily want separation from Ukraine. They want Ukraine unified, but they want local autonomy. And they define it as having the right to elect their own officials. Well, anybody living in America knows that in states, people elect their own governors. In cities, they elect their own mayors. Well, not in Ukraine. Kiev decides who'll be the mayors, who'll be the governors, who'll be the council members. Well, that's about as opposite democracy as I can imagine. Well, they want the right to elect their own officials. They want that local autonomy. They want real democracy. They want to have a say in how Ukraine is governed. And they absolutely have a right to have a say. This is what they're voting on. And the language, I saw it in English, translated from Ukrainian. They may have been a little lost in the translation. I saw it stated a couple of different ways on different websites, either independence or self-rule. And if I spoke Ukrainian, I know exactly what the language said and meant. And if it was in Russian, I would know exactly as well. But it's very easy to lose something in the translation. Basically, I think it comes down to local autonomy. I think listeners to this program would agree that all of us have a right to local autonomy, especially in terms of being able to elect our own officials and not have them appointed for us, including people who represent us in Washington or in other European countries in their capitals. I mean, that's what democracy is supposed to be. Well, there is none in Ukraine now, and of course Washington opposes it in America. It opposes it everywhere. But the voting continues. It does so under conflict conditions. I've been monitoring this all day, and literally new information keeps popping up. I wrote an article this morning, and I discovered more information, enough to have a second article, which I'm into, and I'll finish when this program is over. And maybe before the day is over, there'll still be more new information, and I'll have something more to write about. But the latest I know is that overnight tonight, Sunday, early Monday morning, pre-dawn, in Ukraine, preliminary results will be reported, and very possibly before the end of the day, Monday, Ukraine time, final results will be posted. I think based on the way things are going, there's no question that the yes vote about local autonomy will prevail overwhelmingly. But I would rather see it for myself and see exactly what the numbers are, and then I'll judge. Western media's were invited to come. Western representatives were invited to come to monitor the vote. They refused to come. But there are 470 international journalists on the ground watching things, monitoring them. There are local journalists on the ground doing the same thing. We'll see the reports that they put out. Some will be independent. Some will be very biased. But it will get a sense based on what these journalists have to say. And I recommend to listeners that they follow reports from Russia Today. I'm sorry, formerly Russia Today, RT International, from Voice of Russia, from Press TV, and hopefully you'll follow my articles, because I've literally been writing articles on Ukraine every single day, except for one, since mid-February. That's almost 3 months. I have never done anything like that before, because it's a major issue, and so much new information keeps coming out on a daily basis that it's impossible to ignore it, and it's vital to discuss it. And I've said many times before, I've written it, I've said it on this program, that without question, the crisis in Ukraine is the gravest one since World War II. And that gives me a chance to mention the title of my new book just out. I'm editor and I'm also contributor. It's got marvelous contributors, and it's titled Flashpoint in Ukraine: How U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. The analysis is really extraordinary. I give total credit to the contributors. They're absolutely marvelous people. They told the story the way people need to understand it. And all the chapters basically do not overlap. They cover different issues, major ones, important ones. Anybody reading this book, it's already available for print on demand. We finished up everything just a couple of days ago. My Clarity Press editor got me to write, to add an additional short. I had two chapters in the book. She and I both were very concerned about the massacre in Odessa last Friday on May 2nd, and she asked me to write about it, which I did. I expanded my introduction. I included information on a couple of other things that she wanted covered, and she separated what I wrote about the Odessa massacre into a separate chapter, and that became a third chapter by me. It's in the book. That's covered. Very important, and that's very current information because it's only a week old. And the story that came out over the major media, and even over responsible media, even the first article I wrote about it and then discovered I was wrong, I told the story completely wrong, and I discovered new information. And in my chapter in the book, I explain it the way it needs to be explained, where the original story saying fire consumed 47 people in the building, well, fire had nothing to do with consuming anybody. There were right sector neo-Nazis inside. They shot people in cold blood. They strangled them to death. They beat them to death. They threw them out of windows. That's the true story of what happened in Odessa. And it wasn't 47 people who died. It was around 300, and many others were injured. And the people who survived were absolutely very, very fortunate. And I somebody emailed me in Ukrainian translated into English, an eyewitness account of a woman who was inside the building in riveting detail. I wrote an article, it's on my blog site, anybody can access it, in riveting detail explaining what she saw. She didn't see everything, but she saw plenty, and it made that article extremely long, mostly based on her comments. Again, she was there. She saw it. How she got out alive, I'm not sure, but she did, and she told the story, and it deserved an article separately that went up on my blog site. Too late to get in the book. I told my Clarity, Stephen, I'm just about done. I want to let you jump in. I told my Clarity editor about it, but she had just about brought the curtain down. The train left the station on the book, and it was too late to include it, and that would have really messed up her pagination. She already had to change it once because of my Odessa chapter, but this would have made the short Odessa chapter a very, very long one, so we simply did without it, and even without her eyewitness testimony, I had a much briefer eyewitness testimony in my article explaining what went on without her riveting story. Stephen, welcome. I didn't mean to go on so long. Let me let you jump in on this and other issues that you have in mind to discuss.
Hello, Stephen. No, I'm happy to focus on this. Well, what I would point out is, you're describing what's going on in eastern Ukraine. The other side of it is that Western governments, President Hollande of France has seen these referendums as illegitimate. Angela Merkel in Germany similarly criticizes them. London and Washington are also very critical. So, if it is, as you are describing it, an effort at self-rule and at autonomy, it's very interesting that all the Western governments lockstep are taking the opposite point of view.
Oh, very definitely. It is a step for local autonomy. There are some people in eastern Ukraine, Stepan, that would prefer to align with Russia. And one of the leaders in one of the regions of the referendums said this is his personal preference, but it has nothing to do with the referendum that was held. And he added something to the effect that maybe later on we can consider having a second referendum that would ask the question, do you want to stay in Ukraine or do you want to align with Russia, and then let people decide yes or no. And that's the way people are voting today on the question asked about local autonomy. A simple yes or no, either way, without making it complicated. And it looks like people very definitely are saying yes to local autonomy. But it is local autonomy. It's got nothing to do with separation. It's completely misreported in the West, Stepan. Just awful reporting. And I've spent so much time debunking the official reports coming out of Washington, other West in capitals, and out of the major media. They just have the story exactly upside down.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying, though, is how do you explain, then, that the governments themselves in the West are not seeing this as a democratic process in the Ukraine? That was why they're taking a completely opposite point of view.
Because the goal of America, Stepan, which has been America's goal since the Soviet Union's dissolution in 1991, was to literally co-opt all the former Soviet republics and Warsaw Pact countries, including eventually Russia. Well, of course, it doesn't co-opt Russia now, but Ukraine, of all the other countries, Ukraine is the crown jewel in the heart of Europe, a very large country, a very important country, straddles east and west, and Russia, of course, would be the ultimate crown jewel, and that's what Washington really wants, to get all of these countries' sovereign independence simply annihilated to make them pro-Western vassal states. That's the game out of Washington, and the European countries very sadly go along, even though to a large extent they harm their own interests. For them to impose sanctions on Russia, it's so counterproductive for them. Washington has a fairly small amount of trade with Russia compared to Western Europe. I forget the precise figure, but it's maybe $50 billion, $70 billion, something like that. I mean, it means a lot to the U.S. corporations that engage in it, but Western Europe has something like $400 billion. And I wrote one article, Stepan, citing and quoting. This was about Angela Merkel when she came to Washington a week ago Friday. German industrialists from Siemens, from BASF, from Volkswagen, from other companies, from Germany's largest bank, Deutsche Bank, they are absolutely against imposing sanctions. Why? Because it hurts profits. That's why they're against it. And they're very angered about mixing politics with anything that can harm their revenues and harm their profits, and they really put the heat on Angela Merkel, the chancellor, and they didn't do it silently. They went public on this. But also U.S. corporations are unhappy about this, and other Western European countries are unhappy about this. And I believe no matter what Washington does, the European countries will never go along with the extreme harsh sanctions that Washington is pressuring them to impose. In other words, hit Russia's economy. They won't do that.
Right. No, I understand all that. I'm pointing out the extreme irony that, you know, the West stands for, symbolically, autonomy, self-rule, and democracy. And in terms of Western media and Western government, it is condemning the process that you're describing in Ukraine. It's very, very ironic.
Well, it really is. And yet, from all of the research and writing that I've done, Stephan, that's exactly the way it turns out. And look at the work that you've done, your book on Iraq, and the horrors that the government sends young men, some of them just boys in their teens, off to fight a foreign war on false pretenses, and then they hang some of them out to dry to get superiors off the hook for the crimes that the superiors are responsible for, and they let some of the lesser ones take the fall, and they put them in prison irresponsibly. And you wrote a very important book discussing all that.
Yeah, there does not seem to be any movement whatsoever in terms of interest in the soldiers who are at Fort Leavenworth. You know, the media is not covering them. There are no efforts at clemency. There's absolutely no efforts at getting a pardon for some of these soldiers. You know, they're serving out their maximum sentences. So again, it's something that's sort of fallen through the black hole of information.
Well, there really is, and of course the U.S. media says absolutely nothing about them. The idea that people who never should be in prison are languishing there under very harsh conditions, and the U.S. media just ignores them.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
And the same media completely mistells the Ukraine story. But it's true the way they reported the Iraq war. I remember the daily front page feature stories in the New York Times by Judith Miller that were nothing more in the run up to the war in 2003 and before the war began in March 2003. In 2002 mainly, and early 2003, her front page story, she became completely discredited. Her front page stories were nothing more than Pentagon press release handouts, and they got featured on the New York Times front page. And then you see the same stuff repeat in Libya. It's repeating now in Syria, and the Ukraine story is being completely, completely misreported. The only thing good about it, Stepan, is the New York Times and Washington Post and the rest of the U.S. media, they give me plenty to write about. I'm sure they know about me.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
I have been unforgiving, to say the least, and of course I shouldn't be forgiving. I mean, the lies that they proliferate, it really is deplorable, but yet they keep doing it. I'll add this to the Ukraine story very briefly. With everything going on now, I honestly believe that the worst is yet to come, and I think that goes right to the title of the book, that there's a risk of this thing escalating to the extent where there would be a threat of World War III. And it's something nobody could predict. But who predicted World War I or World War II, and they happen? Is it unreasonable to think there couldn't be a third global war, especially when America wants to target Russia and eliminate it as a major rival, also do the same thing as China? This is going on right now, and both countries are absolutely furious. They want nothing to do with this. But America is encircling both countries with U.S. bases, putting up so-called defensive missiles that have nothing to do with defense and everything to do with offense. And Russia especially is absolutely outraged about what's going on. And it says so diplomatically. It could be very, very much harsher in what it says, but it responds diplomatically, and things at some point push may come to shove, and we may see something that hopefully never will happen, but there is a major risk of an East-West confrontation, and I dread the thought of it.
How do you see the other European, Western European players aligning themselves? Do you see them aligning with the United States if your prediction of World War III comes through?
I think they're aligning to us to some extent, but not beyond it. In other words, they'll do nothing to harm their local businesses, the business interests. These are the people that put them in office, so they don't want anything to bite the hand that's feeding them. But they're going along with too much with Washington on Ukraine. In the second article that I'm writing for tomorrow, I went back to a Henry Kissinger, of all people, a Henry Kissinger op-ed in the Washington Post in early March. And Henry Kissinger, for the war criminal that he was for so many years, his rap sheet is one of the worst in America's history. And in it, he largely wrote a very, very sensible article, and he said things like, to settle the Ukrainian issue, you need both sides to come together responsibly. They need to cooperate. You can't have a tug-of-war. You can't have Western countries and Russia having a tug-of-war. Shall Ukraine turn west? Shall it turn east? It really needs to go both ways. He called Ukraine a bridge between the east and west in Europe. And he's right. It's a bridge and you need cooperation. And he was worried. He didn't go so far as to say there's a risk of World War III. He should have said something a little stronger in that respect. But he did express, or at least imply, a great concern that if something isn't done, and this was over 2 months ago, that we're really heading for something very, very serious. So in that respect, he was very prescient. I'd like to see him do a follow-up article to it now and see what he has to say. But I quoted him extensively because I thought a lot of what he had to say was very sensible.
I would think that the flashpoint that might lead to more global conflict would be in the Middle East. I mean, we got Iran, which is seen as a huge threat to the United States. We've got Israel constantly saying that it's going to take out the nuclear facilities in Iran on its own, etc. I'm not so convinced that Ukraine is really the flashpoint that you're saying that it is, as opposed to the Middle East.
Oh, I think the Middle East is definitely a flashpoint also, and Iran is really the major flashpoint. The situation in Syria is very much unresolved, and I've written much on Syria as well, Stepan. I've only written a few things lately, and I have a written article I haven't gotten out, because on the 3rd of June, Syria will have literally its first democratic presidential election in its history. Bashar al-Assad will stand for office. The little poll information that's out shows him overwhelmingly popular, and I can understand that. If I was a Syrian, I'd vote for him, even though he's not my favorite leader. But compared to the alternative, if he's defeated, it would be a horror situation for the Syrians, and he's the only person standing in the way of the invaders sent there by Western countries, mainly Washington, with Saudi money, literally ravaging this country for over 3 years. And he's been waging war to get rid of these people. And every time an area is liberated, when Syrian soldiers show up, the people turn out rapturously welcoming them. And a few times that Assad has shown up in one of these communities, they come out in huge numbers, thanking him for what he's done, even though the country is so badly damaged and many tens of thousands have been killed. But I've said before, Obama literally engaged in direct war against Syria last summer, but overwhelming U.S. public opinion stopped him. And at the time I said he didn't end his notion of directly attacking Syria. He simply postponed it for another time, and I believe that he absolutely does want to attack Syria, so that war very much continues. But the big crown jewel of the Middle East is Iran, Stepan, and that's mm-hmm. the country that Washington targets. And they're engaged in nuclear talks right now, even though everybody knows that Iran doesn't have a military nuclear program; it has a peaceful one. But they're going through these talks, and the public information I've gotten indicates that they're making great progress for really coming up with a responsible solution. But I will it happen? I'm very, very skeptical that it will happen, because it will happen if Iran accedes to the will of Washington, but if it doesn't, I don't see any chance that it will happen. So there's a great possibility we could see a conflict erupt against Iran, and that would indeed be an extremely major one.
Yeah, it seems like a very tumultuous time. I mean, there's so many fronts across the globe. And of course, the other thing that's going on is China is rising as a economic power and as a military power, and it, of course, it has conflicts over those islands with Japan. There's a whole number of flashpoints all throughout Asia, it seems.
Oh, indeed, and the islands are one issue. Very definitely one issue, and America sides with Japan. The big issue is Obama's so-called Asian pivot, whereby 2020 he wants something like 60% of America's military might, overseas military might, refocused away from the Middle East into Asia, seeing China as a major threat. Well, the only threat China poses to America or anybody else, anybody important, is they're about to become the world's number one economic power, and Washington simply can't handle the notion that it will drop from number one to number two, Stepan. So it's trying to do everything it can to weaken China.
Right.
It's a fool's game. It really is a fool's game. Sooner or later, I mean, America seems to find new ways to shoot itself in the foot, and America makes more enemies than friends. I mean, sooner or later, you're going to find out, America is going to find itself increasingly isolated. I mean, it's made enemies out of Russia and China. It's made enemies out of other countries. I think a lot of the countries that go along with America really don't want to, but they're scared because they don't want America to wage war on them. So they publicly go along, but privately they're very much opposed to America's imperial agenda. Sooner or later, we're going to see more of these countries go public.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in your analysis early in this program is that, like you said, the Western Europeans have huge economic trade and ties with Russia, and it just seems very odd that the U.S. is pushing for harsh sanctions, which it needs to do in unison with the Western powers, and it's very clear that the Western powers, you know, Western European powers don't want to do it. So, you know, one of the more optimistic scenarios is that the sanctions are not going to come through, and maybe, you know, this will have a peaceful resolution. You're going to have the votes, the referendums, and the Ukrainian people will choose for themselves what they want. You know, is that a possibility in your scenario?
Oh, I guess
anything. Resolution?
I guess anything is a possibility, Steph, but I'm overall rather pessimistic in what I see in Ukraine. Whether it'll erupt into something way, way beyond what it is now, who can tell? But the possibility is very much there. And from what I see unfolding, and the rulers, I mean, there was a coup d'etat in Kiev. It was supported, it was initiated, it was manipulated by Washington, and the democratically elected government that was far from perfect. It's not a government I'd want governing me by any means. It was a rotten government, but the people of Ukraine elected it, which gave it legitimacy. Washington toppled the government. The people running Ukraine now in Kiev are fascists. They're fascists, and there are elements, there are very strong neo-Nazi elements in the government, and they have responsible positions in the government, very responsible positions, including for national security and other top posts. And these people openly display their neo-Nazism with SS insignia, with Iron Crosses, with Celtic Crosses, and with Sieg Heils in public. I mean, this should scare anybody. There's extreme anti-Semitism in eastern Ukraine. In some of the communities, people have already made provisions. This was something that my editor wanted me to add to the book, and I did it in the introduction, that in at least two communities I discovered, rabbis have already made arrangements with buses. One of them has 70 buses fueled and ready to go to evacuate people on short notice if they have to, because during World War II and the lead up to World War II, especially World War II, many, many Ukrainian Jews were slaughtered by the Nazis, and the people were either taught or they have long memories of any who are still alive, and they fear that the kind of people governing Ukraine today might repeat what happened before. So it's a very, very grave situation, and literally we could see a tremendous internal conflict. This is what I wrote about. It's in the book. And we could see a repeat of what happened in Nazi Germany. And, of course, that exploded into World War II. It's possible what's happening could explode into World War III. But as long as you have fascists running a country, all bets are off on what's likely.
Yeah, I think that's very important, and that's totally neglected in the Western media. because Ukraine did indeed have a very, very anti-Semitic and strong program, and some of those people, well, some of them are still alive, and certainly some of those, if you want to call them traditions, are still alive. So I think, you know, that kind of reigniting of that dark historical past, I think that's a you know, very, very dangerous thing. I'm glad you're pointing that out.
Oh, it really is. I'm just looking at an article. I haven't read it yet, but it's on Global Research. Anybody can access it. And the title of the article is Ukraine Regime Pays Tribute to Adolf Hitler, period. Kherson governor calls Hitler, quote, liberator. That explains the threat going on to all of Ukraine, not just Western Ukraine or Eastern Ukraine, but the entire Ukraine and the entire region and really the entire world, Stefan.
Wow.
I was right. Let's do this. My goodness, the first half of the program passed fast. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back. Welcome back. I think I know that guy who made that announcement. That was pre-recorded. I recorded that some time ago. I recorded several others over the years I've been with PRN. It's good to hear it. I hope it is on other programs rather than so much my own. I think Stephen, you and I can handle mine live on our own, and on the pre-recorded programs we can do the same thing pre-recorded as opposed to live. But again, it really is a vital issue, and it's the reason I stay on it all the time.
Yeah, I was wondering, since you brought that up before the break, what are the, do you know the facts and statistics of what, you know, how many Jews in Ukraine were exterminated, and what's the percentage of Jews today in Ukraine?
I think it might have been over 200,000 during the Nazi era, and Ukraine has about 46 million people. I think it may have something on the order of about 3 million Jews. It's a pretty large Jewish population. And Odessa, which is the third largest Ukrainian city, population of about 1 million, it has somewhere on the order of between 200,000 and 300,000 Jews. And the Odessan people, especially after the week ago Friday massacre, are especially concerned that maybe they'll be targeted. They could be targeted individually. Their communities could be targeted. And there have already been instances in Western Ukraine of synagogues being attacked, damaged, either burned or desecrated. This is the kind of stuff that went on in the early 1930s in Nazi Germany. And then it escalated to so much more. So Ukrainians have a lot to fear, Stepan. I'm Jewish. If I was a Ukrainian, I'd be making plans to get out right away.
Right. You know, out of all the countries that have been studied extensively by historians, you know, after the Holocaust, Ukraine's gotten about the least amount of attention. We really don't know that much detail about what went on in there. In fact, the entire anti-Jewish program in Western Russia and then in Eastern Ukraine, is something that's sort of a footnote. Much more is known about Poland and about other countries, in Europe itself rather than Ukraine. So one of the things I'm wondering is, what happened to the collaborationist government, after the war?
Oh boy, well, so much change after the war. There were so many promises made by the West, especially America, and so many promises broken. And we can see what happened post World War II, post the dissolution of Soviet Russia. And instead of responsible policies, we saw such horrors going on. I mean, the Korean War right after World War II, just a few years when Harry Truman was president. And then Dwight Eisenhower was responsible for the beginnings of the Vietnam War. And Jack Kennedy picked up the mantle, but he wanted the war ended and all the troops brought home. And after people who wanted none of that got rid of him, Lyndon Johnson accelerated the war. and we've seen one thing after the other. And there really was a chance, Stepan, after the Soviet Union dissolved, that there really could be East-West reconciliation. And exactly the opposite happened, and we can see where we are now, where one conflict leads to another nonstop. There hasn't been a single year of peace in the entire Bush administration, in the entire Obama administration, and there won't be right through the end of his administration in January 2017. And whoever succeeds him, I think the same horrors will continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's hard to argue that. I mean, there's no seismic shift in the policy.
There really isn't.
Yeah.
But there's so much to be gained from peace over war, and if the money, analysts have examined this and written books about this, if all of the money spent on militarism and wars went into commercial development, important things, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's other things that create non-military civilian jobs, if all of that money went in that direction, the economy would be much more prosperous. And of course, the idea of a prosperous economy in a world at peace, what could be better than that? But instead, it goes in the opposite direction for death and destruction. There's less economic growth, the economic cycles are more violent, and so many people suffer so much, and there's no country more guilty of all of this going on than America.
Yeah, it's true also in academia. You know, many, many years ago, there was a Harvard sociologist named Pichim Sorokin. He was Russian.
Yes.
He, in fact, established the Department of Sociology at Harvard. Anyway, he established something called the Center for Altruism, where he wanted to pour research money into studying what you're talking about, how to make peace, how to preserve peace. He also wanted to study saints and sainthood, what it means, how to achieve it, and things of that sort. It ran for maybe 5 years or so. Funding was pulled. It disappeared. It's never been replaced. You know, there's very few, you know, centers that resemble his Center for Research in Altruism anywhere in the United States. So academia itself is more poised to study warfare and rational choice theory and how to use it in warfare and things that promote warfare than it is to studying peace and altruism.
Oh, indeed. So I think he was teaching at Harvard when I was there, but I never took a course with him. From what you're saying about him, oh, I really missed something. I guess he would have been a marvelous professor to take a course with.
Well, yeah. I mean, but he's been written out of the sociology books and out of the history books, and he's the one that actually established the first sociology department at Harvard.
He established it. I'm looking at a Wikipedia page for him, and it says he was a vocal critic of his colleague Talcott Parsons.
Well, I
knew about Talcott Parsons there. I think he was a very well known sociologist at Harvard when I was there. But I didn't know about Sorokin, and that was my great loss. Because I only had a couple of professors there that were really, as I like to say, on the right side of history, and he absolutely probably would have gone to the head of the class. What I missed.
Yeah, well, all of us missed it. I mean, what you're reading there in Wikipedia, Sorokin is not even mentioned, at least he's on Wikipedia. He's not even mentioned in sociology books. It's like he didn't exist. Sorokin, in fact, hired Parsons, and then it was Parsons who got all the fame and all the influence, and Sorokin was just forgotten. But Sorokin was always critical and criticizing the very things that you're talking about, you know, the tendencies towards warfare and barbarism, and he was always pushing the opposite, peace and altruism. And I guess it's a message that just did not resonate.
It sure didn't resonate. It didn't resonate based on my time there, except for the two professors that I had. One was a political science professor in a marvelous course, and the reason he was so anti the things going on now was in the 1930s, he lived in Nazi Germany, and he absolutely reviled fascism. And that wasn't the topic of his course, but the undertone of what he taught, it really came out. And he was marvelous. And the other man was a biologist or a microbiologist. I had him in a required natural science course, And he was absolutely marvelous.
George Wald. Must have been George Wald.
Yes, George Wald, exactly. And,
right.
And he, a Nobel Prize winner later on. And, but a friend of Howard Zinn, when they were in Boston alive. And I think his wife way outlived him. And I was advised to try to get his wife on my, on this program. I tried to contact her. I got her email address. I never got an answer. I don't know whether it was, I didn't get a failure notice, so it must have been an active email address, but getting her on, and I think she was very like-minded with her husband, it would have been marvelous getting her on, but I think she was too old. She probably was well into her 80s, and maybe simply didn't want to do anything like this. So it was a little bit too late. The other man was Sam Beer, Professor Sam Beer, the most dramatic professor I had, in college or in graduate school. Flaming red hair, dramatic speaker. he had the largest class on campus, the most popular course. I was with 700 other students, and he taught me to take notes. Everything he said was so important. He taught me to take notes, and what I did was I used to sit in the back. Nobody could ask questions. He lectured. So you just listen. He taught me to put my head down, listen closely, and take extensive notes at the same time, and I was able to do it. My hands worked better, I could write faster, and the notes from his course were just terrific, and his course was terrific. He was marvelous. And I might have gotten him on this program. I didn't know that he lived to about age 96. And what I read in his obituary, his Harvard obituary, it said his mind was still sharp to the end. He would have been a marvelous guest, Stefan.
Yes.
Well, I would have asked him about Nazi Germany and about the things that get discussed on this program, and I would imagine he would go along with the things that you and I are talking about and be very, very uncomfortable about the policies of the U.S. government.
Right. Well, it's an industrial military complex, and it's got academia, and it's got, you know, a whole number of other institutions intertwined with it. It's not just the government. It's the media is involved, academics are involved. You know, it's a total kind of synthesis of things, of institutions.
Oh, it really is, and it's the reason the New York Times, which is the major publication, the major world publication, it has global influence. The New York Times literally marches in step with the worst U.S. policies, supports all the wars, supports all the lawlessness, turns truth on its head, as I like to say, and I'm positive that the people at the New York Times know me, Stepan. The most popular article I ever wrote on one website got nearly 50,000 readers, and it was an open letter to New York Times editors. Absolutely remarkable, and it really encouraged me, because it told me that a lot of people are very, very upset with the kind of garbage they're getting from the major media, and to have somebody criticize them and do it. I wasn't impolite. I did it very polite, but I held the Times' feet to the fire, and I said a lot of things that needed to be said. And, well, of course, it falls on deaf ears because they support
right.
the power structure.
Right. I imagine they did not respond either directly or indirectly to your time.
Not at all. I've even emailed them a couple of times saying, why don't you give me op-ed space? You don't have to pay me a dime. Give me op-ed space to write an opposing view, provided you don't edit what I write. Fat chance.
Right.
And I had a friend I've lost contact with. She was very elderly. I don't know if she's even still alive. But when I began writing, she asked me, why don't you write articles for the New York Times? And I said the only way I could do it would be if there's a publication by that name on another planet. Which is true. They would never take anything from me. I would volunteer to be a free writer for the New York Times. Or the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, or my own Chicago Tribune, but they wouldn't touch me. And I've never been on U.S. television, never been on CNN, or MSNBC, or NBC, or CBS, never been on. I was once invited on a Fox News radio station in Texas, And they read one of my articles. It was something about the U.S. prison system. It was a few years ago. And when broadcast time came along, I was waiting for the phone call that never came, and I emailed the show's host, and the next day I got a response back saying, well, breaking news came up, and we couldn't have you on. Well, I don't know what the breaking news was, but he said, well, we'll reschedule you. Well, I was never rescheduled. I think somebody else caught a whiff of my name and said, don't you dare have this guy on. But it would have been great to get airtime on Fox News. The listeners would have heard stuff they never heard before. Maybe somebody else will make a mistake and I'll get a chance to come on.
I think it's too late. I think they're going to, all they got is Google you. And it's over.
I think they're on to me. I think they're really on to me. But I would love a crack at them. I once had an online debate with National Public Radio's media ombudsman. I criticized the Lira NewsHour, and I challenged him. I said, why don't you invite me on one of your programs instead of the people that you only invite on? You know, the one side of the issue with the other side never having any say. Why don't you invite me on one time? I'll go down to the local studio in Chicago. It's a real trek from where I live, but I'll go there if you let me on the NewsHour. Well, I was never invited.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
It's not surprising. It really is a trek, but if I ever got invited, I absolutely would go on. I'd love to go on.
Let me ask you, the information you obtained about the neo-Nazis in Kiev, has that information made it onto CNN or Fox or, you know, any kind of Western media outlets?
The closest it comes to getting mentioned is that these outlets will quote, not people like me, but the people in Eastern Ukraine saying, calling these people fascists. So they'll quote them, but the undertone is to discredit them and literally claiming, without even saying it, that this is the legitimate government of Ukraine and it should be respected. It almost calls them Democrats, but they're not Democrats, but they supported the violence that took place beginning last year and really beginning in February, leading up to the February 21-22 coup. They supported the violence and these fascists were the ones that were committing it. There were other protesters in Independence Square, the Maidan as it's called. There were other protesters, but most of them were nonviolent against the government they disapproved of, which I would have disapproved of, but they weren't violent, and the violent people were these fascists, including people in windows, in nearby buildings, in rooftops, killing over 100 Ukrainians, including police force, and policemen. They were the ones responsible, and an Estonian prime minister went to Kiev, talked to people there who understood what was going on, and he had a conversation that I quoted with the European foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, explaining this to her, that the Yanukovych government, the democratic government, had nothing to do with this. These other people were entirely responsible, and the only thing Ashton could say was to make comments like, oh my gosh. She literally used the word gosh. These were the kind of comments that came up. Well, these were the people responsible. Then we had the coup, and the Western media supported.
Right. Well, we in the West, we're so used to putting a spin on things that we can take something that's a violent, you know, overthrow, a coup, basically, and call it democracy. That's something that happens routinely.
Oh, indeed it does. And, I mean, the same thing happening with puppet governments installed in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There was a phony election in Afghanistan I wrote about. A runoff has to happen, and we won't know who the president is. It happened weeks ago. We won't know who the new president is, maybe until the fall. That's how convoluted the process is there. But all the candidates who are competing were exactly opposite of the ones that Afghans want. So these are the choices, and they'll get another Western puppet becoming the president. We have an Egyptian election coming up. I believe it's at the end of May. Same thing. We had a coup d'etat there, and it's interesting, Stepan, that some of the Western media, including the Washington Post, very, very much opposed to the coup leader in Egypt, this General al-Sisi, trained by the Pentagon. He deposed the legitimately elected government. He is the only candidate running for president, which means he's the new president as soon as they have the election. And even the Washington Post and I think some of the other Western media are not happy about him and the things that are going on. One of the things he did was en masse, he sentenced hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood supporters of the former government to death. Sentenced them in a mock trial to death with no appeal, and there were two tranches of this. There were hundreds in one trial, there were hundreds in another trial. This is the kind of government that's going on in Egypt, and it's even gotten some of the Western media very, very upset.
Right. Have those executions been carried out? And I heard about the sentences. Have they been carried out?
I think most of them have not been. There may have been some, but I think most of them are still sitting there. But what's going to happen, the only thing that can really stop them, I think, is enormous Western pressure. Now, whether it'll happen or not, I don't know. But it's a horrible situation. I've written a number of times about Egypt. I've focused on Ukraine mostly. But you've got a very similar situation in Egypt. And I call this Al-Sisi, Egypt's Pinochet. That was the title of one of my articles. That's exactly what he is.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Putschist government gets solidified, it very much is not solidified in Ukraine now. If it gets solidified, and if somehow it diffuses the resistance in the east, then we're going to see the same kind of situation all across Ukraine. I mean, the reign of fascism, we know what that is, Stepan. We know what it is. We know what it does. It'll tolerate no opposition. And you'll see what's happening now with the military and right-wing thugs, neo-Nazi thugs, will come out and murder people. And in one of my articles, I include 400 Blackwater-type mercenaries were sent to eastern Ukraine, the same types that went to Iraq and killed people in cold blood, and they could do it unaccountably. And they're in eastern Ukraine right now in a number of cities, and you know why they were sent. They're sent to kill people, to get rid of the resistance. And if they sent 400, they could send 400 more.
Right. Well, even though this is all very pessimistic, and I agree with you, I still think there's a silver lining in that because the West is not unified, because the Western European governments, Merkel and Hollande and so forth, are not publicly going along with the sanctions, I think we may have an optimistic, there's a possibility of an optimistic ending to this, that the referendums will prevail and it doesn't mean that the fascists are going to win this time because the support seems to be waning in the West.
I would say the best outcome, Stefan, would be for the eastern Ukrainians to prevail, to get local autonomy, for Western pressure to subside beginning in Western Europe. If it subsides there, it probably would subside a little bit in Eastern Europe. There would be reverse pressure put on Washington to let up a little bit. And I agree with you. I never lose hope, because I think if you lose hope, you lose everything. So as dire as things look now, there very definitely is a possibility that things could turn out the opposite of what I fear. And if that happened, it would be wonderful, because if a good resolution can come in Ukraine, it could be a model for the same thing to happen in the other countries that America has gone to war with, establishing puppet governments. People there could replicate responsibly what Ukrainians did, get rid of the puppet regimes, get democratic ones replacing them, and instead of being in such the wrong direction for so many years, we could start moving in the right direction. As we both know, things don't change overnight. They take lots and lots of time. But if we could only just stop the stuff going on now and reverse the momentum and shift it in the opposite direction, then anything is possible. And we may not live long enough to see a great outcome way down the line on all the countries. But if it starts moving in the right direction, it's very possible it could keep going that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's the hope.
That's what I work for every day. That's the reason I write. That's the reason I host this program. That's the reason I encourage other people to support the same kinds of things and get behind it and not just think it and not just talk about it, but do something about it. One of my expressions, Stefan, is wishing doesn't make it so. If you don't get off your butt and do something, do anything. I write, I host this program. I get interviewed all the time. Everybody can do something. I don't care how busy you are. I'm busy 7 days a week, many, many hours. I'm almost 80 years old. If I can do it, everybody listening can do it too. You got your family, you got your jobs, you got time to go to the movies, you got time to go out to dinner, you got time to go shopping. Why don't you use some of that time to change the world the way it needs to be changed?
Wonderful.
Well, if people don't care about their own welfare, Stepan, who the devil is going to care about them for them? Nobody is going to care for them. You got to take care of yourself. You got to look after your own welfare. And you and I are still old enough to remember the anti-war protests in the 1960s and the 1970s. They were wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful.
I try to tell my students about that, and, you know, as a sociologist, what I've learned is talking to them and, of course, you know, examining society is one of the big differences from our generation and today is that they are so inundated today with so much overload of information. And when you have such an overload, it's almost like your organism, your brain just sort of shuts off, that indifference is a kind of defense mechanism. I mean, in those days, we had just a few news outlets. We also talked to each other more. So once you could, you know, reflect upon, deliberate upon, and absorb the information, you could come to a decision, you could make a commitment. Today, the information is coming from so many different factions, and the media themselves have been split into factions. You know, some are pro-left, some are pro-right, that I think people are just paralyzed with an overflow of information. In other words, I don't think the average person knows what's going on in Ukraine, because what they get in the news media, and it's always conflicting, it's always got a different spin on it politically, is totally different from the kind of information which is factual, which you are delivering, for example.
Stupid, I have to end the program, but I absolutely agree with you 100%. 100%. I would say 90%, maybe 95% of Americans never heard of Ukraine before all this stuff started. And 95% of them still don't know anything about what's going on. That's the problem. We have to change it. Stepan, I look forward to having you back. It was a great hour. I wish you took more of it, but it was an important discussion, and it really needs to be repeated all the time. Stepan, I'll shoot you an email when I get off here.
All right. Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Stepan. Join us, tune in to my archive programs. They'll be archived on Thursdays and Fridays. Tune in live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit. Understand what's going on, not just in Ukraine, but the vital issues everybody needs to know about and be willing to do something about it to change the world responsibly. It's up to us. If we don't do it, nobody's going to do it for us.